This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The White House has big new plans for the economy, but whatever you do, don't call it another stimulus program. The nuts and bolts of a business tax break today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Payroll Association in recognition of payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 6th through the 10th. More at nationalpayrollweek.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 7th of September today, and that makes it just 56 days until the fall elections. Ever mindful of that, the White House is getting ready to announce a whole bunch of new proposals it hopes will finally kick the economy into high gear. In particular, the administration wants to get businesses to grow and in the process create more jobs. Obviously, finding what could add up to another $350 billion is going to need congressional approval. There would be new spending on roads and bridges and runways. The research and development tax credit would be juiced up. Another proposal on the table is a big tax break for businesses that invest in plants and new equipment. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman walks us through how that might work.
The proposal would encourage businesses to invest in their facilities or put in new equipment. Potentially, that could cover anything from building renovations and state-of-the-art machinery to better computers or new office furniture.
These kinds of investments would be able to be written off entirely through the end of 2011.
Small business lawyer and tax advisor Barbara Weltman says a business could trim its tax bill for the entire cost right away.
It does free a business from having to keep these records and take the write-offs over a long period of time, even though they may pay for it right up front.
Ordinarily, businesses have to wait 20, 30 years. Sometimes they don't survive that long or don't have enough profits in the short run to even make it worth it. To see how the tax break could play out, I called Chandra Brown. She's a VP at Oregon Ironworks, which has 400 employees and has actually been expanding in recent years.
We make streetcars, boats, and bridges, and aerospace equipment.
The company's got 13 new streetcars on order from Portland and Tucson at $3.5 million a pop, and they're putting in a new facility to road test them before delivery.
We are in the process of building the test track as we speak. It would be millions of dollars that we're investing in that, certainly over $2 million.
Which could be deducted right away from this year's and next year's tax bills and plowed back into the business. Brown says that could lead to more expansion, including more hiring, in the next few years. But not all companies would put the tax savings into more jobs, says Martin Bailey at the Brookings Institution.
Well, the risk is that more equipment just means more productivity and not more hiring.
Critics will point out that as much as the tax break proposal might help healthy businesses that are already in expansion mode, it's not likely to generate more spending by consumers, and that's ultimately what many businesses need to grow. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's more than business and jobs that are wrong with the American economy right now. So today the government rolled out the latest in a long string of programs to stop home foreclosures. It's aimed at houses that are underwater, where the mortgage is more than the house is worth. The Federal Housing Administration wants to encourage lenders to forgive some debt and in the process stop maybe 1.5 million families from just walking away from their homes. Nobody has had much success in fixing the real estate market so far, and Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that some are now saying it's time to stop propping up those prices. The new program is narrowly focused at homeowners who have a stable income and remain current in their payments. The FHA will guarantee a modified mortgage if the lender voluntarily agrees to reduce the balance. Thus far, banks have been reluctant to do that, even though more than one in five mortgages is estimated to be underwater nationwide. The program is aimed at discouraging what's come to be known as strategic default. But at George Mason University, real estate finance professor Anthony Sanders argues most underwater mortgage holders have kept on struggling to stay in their homes.
If the strategic defaults aren't as bad as we feared, why do we have a strategic default program through the FHA?
Sanders predicts the program will help far fewer than the government estimates, and he contends it will disproportionately benefit those in the hardest-hit states. Nevada and Arizona, for example, where more than half of all homes are estimated to be underwater.
So in other words, we're just saying, well, if you happen to live in a state which had catastrophic housing failure, we're going to make people in Kansas pay for your write-down, because someone has to pay for this.
Sanders is among a growing chorus of experts who say the government should let the housing market find its own price level. But at Harvard Business School, former FHA Administrator Nicholas Ratzinas says some government intervention is justified.
The housing sector is too important. It's too important to our economy. It's too important to people's own balance sheet, their own sort of net worth, for government merely to be a spectator.
Ratzinas says, if anything, the government should have intervened more aggressively than it has.
I think they've tried to do the right thing. The problem is it is no longer an issue of the housing market. It's really the broader economy and people losing their jobs.
For that reason, Ratzinas fears the latest housing lifelines may be too little, too late. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Wall Street was in a sour mood all darn day. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Even though he just got out of legal trouble, former Hewlett-Packard CEO Mark Hurd is still going to be seeing a lot of his lawyer. A month after Hurd resigned from HP over some ethics charges, he is being sued by HP over his new job. Oracle announced last night it's hired Hurd as its new co-president. The lawsuit says Hurd will almost certainly wind up sharing HP's trade secrets with his new employer. We've got Marketplace's Steve Henn on the line to find out why Oracle hired Hurd. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Okay, so this lawsuit aside, Mark Hurd has a new gig.
Yeah, that's right. He's been appointed the co-president of Oracle by his good friend and his chief defender, Larry Ellison. You might remember Ellison came out in Hurd's defense when Hurd got in trouble a month ago. He really actually went out of his way. He emailed a statement to reporters calling HP's decision to fire Hurd the worst personnel decision since the idiots on Apple's board fired Steve Jobs.
And it's actually worked out pretty well for Steve Jobs. What's he going to do at Oracle, though?
Well, Oracle just bought Sun Microsystems. And, you know, Sun is a hardware company. They make servers for companies. That's not a business that Oracle has been in until now. They made software. So Sun's been struggling. It faces tough competition from IBM and from HP. So there's a lot of thought that one of Hurd's jobs, if not his chief job, will be to run this business, to start gobbling up market share from his former employers at HP and to make sure that Sun runs as efficiently and effectively as possible.
And that's what Hurd was known for at HP, making things run very, very efficiently.
Yeah, he was a guy who could make the trains run on time. Now, he wasn't really popular here in Silicon Valley. He laid a lot of people off, cut a lot of jobs and salaries at HP, and there was a rap that he didn't invest enough in research and development, and kind of, you know, undermined the HP way, which was like a religion here. Mm-hmm. But Wall Street just loves this guy. He delivered consistent results while he was running HP. Its stock price basically doubled during his tenure. And, you know, you can see that in the reaction today.
Yeah, I mean, Oracle shares were up today. Investors clearly like this. But let me ask you the ethics question. Here we have a guy who was allowed to resign over ethics charges. And a month later, his buddy comes in and says, I'm going to hire you anyway. Ethics, schmethics. I just want to make some money. What does that say about, you know, corporate America today?
Well, I think in the case of Oracle and its investors, they're focused on Hurd's ability to get things done. During his tenure at HP, the stock price soared. It became the largest technology company in the world. And in comparison, they're willing to look over or overlook $10,000, $20,000 in misstated financial reports and some ugly allegations that were never proven. we'll see if this works out. But right now, it looks like Wall Street is pretty enthusiastic about that.
And it does give Larry Ellison a chance to poke a stick in the eye at HP, and it gives Mark Hurd a chance to do the exact same thing to his own company.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure Hurd is more than motivated to take it to his former employers.
Steve Henn at the Marketplace Technology Outpost up in Silicon Valley. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Almost 8 months after the earthquake that leveled most of Port-au-Prince, hundreds of thousands of Haitians are still homeless. They're living in tent cities or other makeshift housing in the slums of the city. Most of them are under 30 years old. They can't get jobs or education or better places to live. So economists are saying they should start looking for a future outside the city. Ruxandra Guidi has more.
This was once the main square of Haiti's capital city, Port-au-Prince. Today, it's a sprawling settlement of some 6,000 people who live under plastic tarps and sheets strewn between clotheslines and trees. Adolphe Miradieu's makeshift home is on the edge of this tent city. He's 27, unemployed, and he's had to abandon his college course in economics.
Young Haitians are committed to going to school, to helping others, and improving their own situation. But the government doesn't offer any hope to them. Here, there are many young people who can work but can't get a job.
Soon after the earthquake, Adolphe's mother moved to the countryside to live closer to her extended family, but Adolphe didn't follow. He says that there is often no electricity, drinkable water, clinics, or schools in rural areas. For 50 years, the government has invested little in infrastructure, services, or agricultural production there. So for Haitians wanting services and opportunity, this city is the place to be. Port-au-Prince was designed for 300,000 people. At last count, it had a population of 3 million. But since the earthquake, more than 600,000 people have moved to the countryside, the government says. Many are looking for a simpler life, focused on food production and community. Carlos Infiniz is 17 years old. Days after the earthquake, he and his family found themselves in a squalid refugee camp in Port-au-Prince. When they heard that the peasant enclave of Papay in the Central Plateau region was welcoming and helping out families like theirs, they moved. The local peasant union gave them a small plot of land where they could grow vegetables, free meals, and a simple home. Carlos says it's a different world from the city.
The young people here have learned a lot. The peasant organization helps them to get basic services, sometimes even school and jobs. I've also noticed that the young people here help each other out more and are generally responsible.
Agronomist Jean-Baptiste Chavan has been calling for decentralization of Haiti's industry and services for more than three decades. He founded the nation's largest peasant cooperative, the Mouvement Paysan Papay, to foster sustainable agriculture in Haiti. Chavan says young people and peasants will have to have a big part in rebuilding the country.
Right now, our plan is focused on building new homes, starting up new family farms, creating jobs, and finding ways to integrate the refugees from the city into our communities. The earthquake isn't the first disaster to destroy Haiti. We've also had hurricanes and droughts, and need to think of this as an opportunity to come up with a long-term plan that benefits both people and the environment.
His approach is increasingly advocated by some international aid agencies and outside economists. They say concentrating industry and services in the cities makes Haiti vulnerable every time a natural disaster strikes these population centers. But to achieve decentralization, the government must invest more in rural areas to encourage people to move there from the cities and to make sure they don't overwhelm the limited rural services once they do arrive. Meanwhile, former urbanites like young Carlos Infiniz are hedging their bets. Right now, he's spending his afternoons out in the fields, helping his father grow sugarcane and corn. But he goes to school in a nearby city. And if he achieves his goal of one day going to college to study journalism, that will not likely be in Papay. In Papay, Haiti, I'm Ruxandra Guidi for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Coming up, are you ready for some football on Broadway?
Our top target is theatergoers, and they're typically, on average, a 45 to 50-year-old woman with an expendable income.
But first, let's do the numbers. Nail-biting over the state of European banks paired some of the value off U.S. markets today. The Dow Industrials fell 107 points, just over 1%, closed at 10,340. The NASDAQ off 24 points, 1.1%, ended at 2208. The S&P 500 filed off 12 points, also 1.1%, closed at 1,091. Banks in Europe reportedly played down their holdings of potentially risky government debt during those stress tests they had over there not too long ago. Barclays U.S. shares tarnished 5.2%. American Express drove down 4%. Deutsche Bank unloaded 3.25% today. Citigroup and Bank of America each left around 2% on the table. Jitters over global recovery also cost energy producers. That as investors lost their appetite for commodities in favor of the dollar. ConocoPhillips leaked 2.5%. Chevron siphoned off 1.2% today. The 10-year T-note gain pushed the yield down to 2.6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is in Cleveland, Ohio. He'll talk about initiatives to support economic recovery. The Federal Reserve releases a couple of regular reports, its Beige Book summary of current economic conditions, and its monthly report on consumer credit looking at July. Walk-in after midnight, perhaps best done during the era of Patsy Cline. The late country singer was born on September 8, 1932. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so how bad is the budget situation out here in California? It is so bad that a top-notch MBA program just wants out. After years of seeing its budget being cut, the Anderson School of Management at UCLA wants to take a shot at giving up taxpayer money altogether. A model, perhaps, for other public universities in financially troubled places? From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
It's not every day a school turns down $18 million, but that's the state funding UCLA's Anderson School would rather do without. Saying no to that money would create a near 20% gap in the school's budget. The school's dean, Judy Olian, has proposed making that up with private donations and tuition increases. She says the school would have a more stable, predictable budget. The university would get to put the money it used to give Anderson toward other programs.
Of course, we would much prefer to stay state-supported, but given the problems associated with state financing and the benefits to the university from this model by redirecting the funds, we think this could be a win-win for all.
The president of the University of California system still has to approve the plan. If he does, Olian says the Anderson School would stay part of that system with its public mission and a curriculum approved by the Academic Senate.
What will not change is our affiliation with the university, what will be seen by the people from the outside in. It'll look and quack exactly like the UCLA Anderson of old.
And there is at least one precedent. The University of Virginia's Darden School of Business opted out of public funding several years ago. Peter McPherson is president of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities. He says most state-funded programs couldn't afford to give up the money.
Even if the total money given isn't a large part of the whole budget, it's usually just critical money that can't be made up by donations or other sources.
The Anderson School already gets more than 80% of its revenue from other sources, like private donors and tuition. And tuition will go up if this plan is approved. It's already $41,000 a year for California residents. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
UCLA's Anderson School doesn't start its fall semester for another couple of weeks yet, but plenty of schools have already begun. Textbooks have been bought. Studying has started. Yeah, all right, maybe not on that one. But class being in session has gotten commentator and college professor Dan Dresner thinking about the state of the modern student.
Everyone knows that with the passing of Labor Day, a new batch of 18-year-olds begins their college years. What is less well known is that this date also marks the start of teachers complaining about the latest crop of students. The refrain has been the same since the days of Socrates. The young people, they ain't what they used to be. As a college professor, I've heard, and perhaps uttered, some of these complaints. Recent data suggests, however, that this lament might contain some truth. A new University of California study reveals that the amount of time college students spend studying has plummeted over the past 50 years, from 24 hours a week in 1961 to 14 hours today. Perhaps this is because students have replaced real studying with cutting and pasting from Wikipedia. According to a recent story in the New York Times, current college students are less troubled by plagiarism than their professors. So, are the kids today ruining everything? Not really. The research reveals that the overwhelming majority of the drop-off in studying time occurred between 1961 and 1981, well before incoming freshmen were born. Indeed, one could argue that online innovations have made the current generation of students more productive studiers than prior generations. Maybe they study less now, but they also study more productively. The attitudes towards plagiarism are potentially more troubling, but much of the Times information in the story seems to rest on anecdote rather than broad-based data. Well, here's an anecdote of my own. I haven't caught any of my students plagiarizing for the past decade. Of course, maybe I'm just a bad detective. Some research suggests that as students matriculate, they develop a better understanding of plagiarism and try harder to avoid it. But it is also worth asking why students might possess more casual attitudes towards plagiarism. One reason, a number of celebrity professors have been caught cutting and pasting other people's work, too. These professors mostly got off with slaps on the wrist. No wonder students might be confused. Today's students are being bombarded with more information, more technology, and more media than ever before. Some professors might say this leaves them brain-fried and desperate to use shortcuts. I say, to quote a recent movie title, that the kids are all right.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. Drop us a line. Tell us what you think. Electronic works best for us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. From the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders to the drama of whether Brett Favre's really going to retire again to the once hapless New Orleans Saints being the defending Super Bowl champions, the National Football League knows a little something about putting on a show. Millions are going to be watching Thursday night when the Vikings and Saints open the 2010 regular season. And the NFL is also running a big play on Broadway this year. A new drama about legendary Green Bay Packers coach Vince Lombardi opens later this month. From New York, Sally Herships has more.
Most football fans know Vince Lombardi. The Super Bowl trophy is named after him, and he's famous for quotes like this.
Winning isn't everything, but it's the only thing. In our business, there is no second place.
In the 60s, Lombardi took the Packers from football nobodies to five NFL championships and two Super Bowls. But let me remind you, we're talking theater here, not football. Tony Punturo is one of the producers of the new play about Lombardi. He says it's not just for football fans.
The show is really about a man who happens to be a football coach. It's also about not giving up your dream. Even if you're not successful at 20 or your 30s or even your 40s, don't give up on your dream.
Sounds like Broadway. Or does it? Not to stereotype, but almost 70% of Broadway patrons are women. So who's going to see this show? I asked Jim Glaub. He's creative director at Art Meets Commerce, the marketing company promoting Lombardi.
Our top target is theatergoers, and they're typically, on average, a 45 to 50-year-old woman with an expendable income.
That's right. He said women. So Glaub says they're focusing on story, Lombardi's relationship with his wife, the players, and the press. Here's an internet ad for the show.
Press is hard on me because I push my players to the brink. But they sing a different song when we win on Sundays.
Jim Glaub says it's great for date night, a play you know your man will like. But it's still risky. Just the advertising budget for a play like Lombardi can run up to $1 million. Then there are lights, music, actors.
What is the statistic for a success show on Broadway? It's like 1 in 100 shows end up being a success.
The National Football League hopes the show will be a success. They're one of the producers, and they expect football fans will come. But if you look at the Lombardi website, you can tell it won't be your typical theater audience based on the frequently asked questions.
Questions like, I've never been to a Broadway show. What should I expect? Do I need to dress up?
Adam Feldman is theater critic for Time Out New York.
They seem to be going for people who have never been to the theater at all, and that is ambitious.
But Feldman says targeting specific audiences can work well. Recently, there have been shows with African-American or Latin themes that have been able to find audiences on Broadway. The only problem with targeted audiences is they're small. Last season, Denzel Washington starred in Fences, the award-winning drama. It only ran from April to July, but it was a hit.
That is something that producers are beginning to discover. Bring in big stars, do a great play, do it really well, run it for 3 months, make millions of dollars.
He's not quite Denzel, but the actor playing Lombardi will be Dan Luria, the dad from The Wonder Years, and Judith Light from Ugly Betty will go on as his wife. So, will football fans spend on Broadway? To find out, I headed to a sports bar in Greenwich Village. It was game night. Packers fan Christine Tilt told me she's never been to a Broadway show. She's not a fan.
Because I don't like singing, I don't like dancing, I don't like choreographed movements, but I love football.
I asked her if she would go see Lombardi.
That's the only one I would go see, ever.
But not during football season. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, in which I try crowdsourcing to help me figure out something that has been bugging me all day. What's up with Google today? You know how on its homepage they sometimes change their logo depending on the day, red, white, and blue for the 4th of July or the Olympic rings during the Olympics or whatever? It's usually pretty clever, but today's is just a little bizarre. The logo is just these little balls that form the word Google, and then they scatter all over the page when you run your mouse over them. No rhyme, no reason, no obvious celebration that I can think of that I'm missing. So help a guy out. If you know what's up, let me know. Letters@marketplace.org or obviously through our website where the logo doesn't change. Marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace on the radio from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 107 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ off 24 points, about 1.1%. The S&P 500 filed off 12 points, also 1.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Rod Abid on our morning report crew. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this show, what kind of manicure costs double the regular price?
Consumers are really looking for this. They're trying to be eco-friendly right now, and they're willing to pay top dollar for that.
Sustainable beauty next time. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.